Hello, everybody. So welcome, welcome. As you know, Rabbi Jay is with a big group of people in Italy, exploring our roots there. And I wish we were all with him, but we're here, and we're very, very honored to have Mordechai Bar-Or come and speak with us. And I'm really glad we have such a big crowd. We weren't sure if there's going to be a crowd this size, so it's very, very wonderful. Mordechai Bar-Or attended Yeshivat Har Etzion and was ordained by the Chief Rabbi Goren in 1984. He received the Avichai Prize for his work in establishing and directing Elul, the first Beit Midrash for secular and religious Israelis studying together. After the assassination of our Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Mordechai Bar-Or founded Kolot, a study center aimed at educating an Israeli leadership that will advance Jewish values and create a meaningful Jewish mission for Israel. He serves as the government advisor to Jewish values and leads a new Jewish values initiative led by President Shimon Peres, who recently visited us, who personally studies with Mordechai. Thank you, and welcome, welcome to Toronto.
Good evening, Shalom Aleichem. Thank you. That's so cool. Thank you. Okay, it's good to be here. The Xeroxing weren't great, so you'll have the basic text I'll teach this evening, but the seven pillars are missing, I think five, so I'll speak about them verbally, but I'll go back and I'll tell you what I do in Israel, and we'll get into some study and have a discussion, hopefully. Israel is facing many issues, Baruch Hashem. We have our external issues, Iran, Syria, Egypt. But for me, as an Israeli, as an educator, as a rabbi, the most important issue that Israel is facing these days is the internal lack of dialogue between the Jews and Israel. And as we know, the first two temples, the first and second temple, were destroyed not because of the Persians or the Romans. It was because of the inner Jewish lack of dialogue, of tolerance. And for me, even though the headlines aren't dealing with this issue on a day-to-day basis, what's happening between Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim? Tel Aviv, which in a way is the majority of Israel, is the secular part of Israel, is a very Western country, speaking Hebrew but eating sushi, investing in the market, living a very, very Western life in general. Yerushalayim, which is where I live, is a city which is, I would say, very Jewish, very Orthodox. And for me, these two cities do not speak to each other. And for me, this is a dramatic problem for Israel of today. After Rabin was assassinated, I was asked by the government of Israel to do dialogue between secular and Orthodox schools in Israel because of the hatred going on to the Orthodox, having Yigal Amir coming out of the non-Orthodox crowd in Israel. And I remember those days. I went to visit a very prominent principal of a secular high school in North Tel Aviv. His name is Ron Chuldai. He's now the mayor of Tel Aviv. In those days, he was the principal of Gymnasia Herzliya, a very, you would say, like an Ivy League high school in Israel. Very secular, but very high-level school in Israel. And I said to Ron, how about your kids in your high school meeting the Orthodox school down the road here, the Tzeitlin school? And he said, what a great idea that my kids meet the Jews. And I said, what? He says, yes, we are the Israelis, and they are the Jews, and it's very good that they get together. And I said, and for me, that way of thinking where Israelis say that they are the Jews and we are the Israelis is a tragedy of modern Israel, where people are saying, we are Israelis, we're 63 years old. The Holocaust, in a way, cut history. And you know, we stay in Israel between the Tanakh and the Palmach, nothing happened. You know, it's as if we totally take away years of history, years of creativity, of Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, the culture of our people. And more Israelis feel that Judaism isn't part of their everyday life. You know, if you ever go to Tel Aviv in mid-December, you'll see on all the signs, on all the roads, there's a very a lot of PR to what they call the Sylvester parties. Now, in this country, no one heard of the Sylvester parties, but it's an import from Russia, where hundreds of thousands of Israelis celebrate the Sylvester party as some kind of a Christian Purim for them. And the next day, in most schools, is off because kids just don't show up to school. And that element of Israel, with all its creativity, with all of Israel's great successes, there's a more and more growth of secular Israelis who feel that Judaism isn't part of their life. Now, I must say that the Haredi politics adds to this hatred. And what has been going on in Israel for many, many years, where there's a very strong voice coming out of the ultra-Orthodox camp of what is Judaism, exactly what it is, and forcing some laws on some Israelis, that didn't add too much love to Judaism. And I left Israel on Saturday night for Toronto. On the way to the airport, I stopped at a demonstration that was going on in Tel Aviv about the quality and trying to get the ultra-Orthodox join the army. I must say, this isn't part of my everyday life in Kolot, but Israel is going through a change. First of all, for the past year, it's the first time I remember in Israel that Israel is dealing with inner questions and not dealing only with external questions. And I think this is a very, very good sign of growth of a country. In America, all you hear all the time is, are you for AIPAC or for J Street? I mean, it's a very kind of, clear cut that Israel is going through an international crisis. But for me, I must say, in the past year, Israelis are starting to talk about what is the quality of life of Israel, why are we there all together, and also this issue of a country supporting the Haredi yeshivot for tens of years, or a whole population which isn't part of the struggle of the IDF, that has to end. And I'm saying this not as part of my everyday life, but something is changing in Israel, and something I think is changing for the good here. But back to the issue of Kolot. So what we do in Kolot is we work with leaders in the country, people from the business world, people from the IDF. We have a lot of IDF hiring officers. We have a program in the Mossad in Shin Bet. We have a program with doctors, altogether 520 students in the ages of 30 to 55, who feel that their, let's say, parents or grandparents rebel too far away from Eastern European Judaism. And they grew up very, very secular. They grew up with very little knowledge about Judaism, and they want to reconnect the Jewish values through Torah study. So we give a two-year course to people who are committed to this. They're all selected. We try to take people who are in a high level of leadership in their businesses, and we study issues and things that we think are very, very relevant for Israel at this time, and the hope is that they will pass this on to their businesses, to their families, and slowly but surely Tel Aviv will become, you know, more and more into Judaism, into Jewish values. 3 years ago, I was approached by President Peres. His two children studied at Kolot over the years, and they said their father wants to study Talmud. And I went to visit him at the president's home, and he had a lot of interest in studying Talmud. And we meet once a week or once every 10 days to study different topics of Judaism. A year ago, and Shimon Peres isn't a typical, what we would say, a person who loves, you know, Judaism in a simple way, but he's going through his own soul searching. And a year ago, close to the death of his wife, so it's a year and 4 months ago, he called me one Friday afternoon, and I was preparing food for my family, and he asked me, do you have plans for Friday night dinner? I said, I do have plans at 4 p.m. on Friday for Friday night dinner. He said, can you come over? So if the president calls you, you cancel your family plans and you go to eat with the president. And he did kiddush, And as I was kind of, what's going on? Why are you so, so emotional? He was very emotional. He says, I have to tell you something. And I was eating, I remember the moment I was having the soup. And he says to me, you know, Mordechai, it can't be only about technology. And I remember, like, I stopped eating. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you know, for years I've been talking about the Israeli technology as the highest element of the Jewish people. And if any of you know Shimon Peres, he has this, it makes him tick. What's happening with the Jewish mind, the technology, the different kinds of technology is exactly what for years and years has made him excited as a Jew. And he said to me, it can't be only about technology. There has to be something else that we share that will give us hope as a people. And he said he's starting to bring together the things that we studied over the past 3 years, 2 years. And he said, can you think with some people, are there core values that we share as Jews? Which means core values that all Jews from all different camps, all different Jewish lifestyles can share and live according to. Now, you understand this task isn't easy in the world where Jews do not speak to each other and definitely disagree on major elements when it comes to Torah, to Judaism. And we decided together to pick a group of people, of rabbis, of educators, of left-wing writers. This is really a Klal Yisrael effort, a very difficult one. And for the past year, my board decided that I should take some time off, and I've been investing a lot of my time in trying to bring together secular and Orthodox men and women, and some people from this country, but mainly Israelis, who can think, do we share values? And it was very difficult. There were people on the right that said that if all Israelis won't sign on Torah Mishamayim, on Torah from heaven, we can't agree to any kind of joint value program. And then there are people on the left who said, if there's any God language there, we're not going to be part of this. So you can imagine that this task is a very difficult task. And I also asked some of my advisors, some of my rabbis, Rabbi Steinsaltz and some others, if it's right to think of seven core values, then maybe we should say there's only the full commandments and the full Tayag Mitzvot, and there's no way to think of, you know, of Ikarim, of pillars of Jewish life. But I must say that in most cases, people felt that it's right to think in these terms. Because if people think of only one way, everybody has to sign up on one way of a Jewish life, we're going to lose Klal Yisrael, and the majority of Israelis aren't into the ballgame of Judaism. So in the past year, I've been working on trying to come up with a thesis of seven core values. And I would like this evening to take one of the values and teach one of them to you, and we'll see how we progress. But that's the idea. And I usually don't speak more than 10 minutes. This will be for people to interfere, and you're a very, you know, you're a listening crowd. But feel free to ask questions as I speak. So, you know, any moment you want to ask me anything about what I'm saying, feel free to do this. Before I go into some of these core values, I want to give you some examples of our work in Israel. The IDF, the Israeli army, it was 6 years ago when we had the Second Lebanon War, exactly these days, 6 years ago. And I don't know if you all, those days in Israel weren't the best days of our modern history. The whole north of the country moved to the center or to the south. Even I would say even more worse than that, the Israeli army did not succeed in hitting the Hezbollah in the way we thought it could be done. Those who think that Israel can easily hit the Iran these days should remember that Israel didn't succeed in hitting with the Air Force the Hezbollah bunkers 6 years ago. Just have this in mind. As much as we admire the Israeli army, that war showed us that we have a lot to learn. And after the war was over, I was asked by the chief of staff at the time to be part of a soul-searching group in the Israeli army It was made out of 11 people, 8 army experts, a rabbi, myself, and 2 other psychologists and somebody else, to think what happened. What happened 6 years ago that Israel did not succeed with this great air force, great army, to really knock out this very small army in Lebanon. Many people tend to forget that summer, but I can't forget that summer. I had a son who was in war, and I was in the first Lebanon war. Never did I think in the first Lebanon war that my son, 25 years later, will be again in war. And I must say, today in Israel, the situation isn't any better than it was in my days in the army. Anyway, we sat for 3-4 months, once every 10 days, in this committee to do a chishbon nefesh, a soul searching. What happened during that war? And there were issues that were very technical. You know, there was missing equipment, very basic stuff that was missing. There was a problem with the intelligence. In part of the means, I couldn't even participate because they were secret. I wasn't supposed to be part of the intelligence part of the. But then there was an element that was very important, and they were saying that the leadership of the army was missing a spark. That there was something about the understanding of what does it mean to have an army at this time of Jewish life, and where does the courage, where does the capability to make decisions that are complicated, that something was missing, some spark was missing in the leadership of the Israeli army. And that's where some of the people they were talking about, that the army needs a fresh mission. Not from a security point of view. Israeli army is all the time getting a better and better air force, the best bombs, but you can't only win with force. There has to be a ruach. There has to be a spirit that will lead the people in the army. And since those days, for the past 4 or 5 years, we've been working with top officers in the army about Jewish values, about Jewish history. Try to give back the feeling that the 63 years after the state started, after 40-something years after the Six-Day War, there's still something very special about having a Jewish army. And this thing, which may sound to you very, very, you know, natural, for many Israelis isn't as natural as it used to be. In my days in the IDF, I was an officer in the tank division. This is some 30 years ago, 25 years ago. When I was looking for a minyan in the morning to daven, we had no minyan in my army base. Today, in every army base, it's like a shtiblach. There are many, many minyanim going on. The number of kippot zrugot, of knitted kippot today in the most advanced combat units has risen tremendously in 20 years. Now, why did that happen? So on one hand, there is a shift of going to the most special units among Orthodox kids in Israel. And something else was happening, that some of the elite of the secular Israelis are finding their way out of the army in the past 5, 6, 7 years. And what used to be, if you go to any elite unit, you would see, 20% kibbutzim, 50% the elite of Tel Aviv, and you have maybe 10% of modern Orthodoxy. Today, those numbers have shifted dramatically. And there are more and more secular Israelis who are finding their way out of the combat units. And for me, as much as I'm proud of my kids in the army as Orthodox kids, this is a big danger for Am Yisrael, because the army used to be a microcosm of the country. And this is changing. There are more and more Israelis who don't understand why should we sacrifice our life, for what? And that's the spark they were speaking about after the second Lebanon war, that something is missing even in the IDF. And these issues, for me, are at the heart of Israel, the ruach, the spirit. Something is missing today to keep us going, because it seems as if the peace process is not going to advance very quickly. And if we don't have a mission, if we don't have a ruach, a spirit, why to go on another 50 years? We just may not make it. And it's not going to help us to have a strong economy and a very strong army if we don't have a Jewish mission, a Jewish understanding of why to live in Israel. So that's why this work that we're doing, teaching secular leaders Jewish values, trying to re-spark their imagination about what is Jewish life all about and what does it mean to have an army at this time? What does it have to have a country at this time that we can't take it for granted? That's at the core of Kolot. I'll just share with you one story. Occasionally, I have nachas in my work. How do you say nachas in English? What? Nachas? You all get this word? Okay. So, 2 years ago, we taught a number of high-ranked officers in the army, and we taught issues of power, you know, different images from the Tanakh, David the Melech, who overused power, and others. And how do you balance power as a leader? And they brought in their dilemmas, and one of the people there became head of all the roadblocks in Yehuda v'Shomron, in Judea and Samaria. There were 71 roadblocks at the time. And he decided to raise money from Israelis, which is itself a miracle to raise money from Israelis, to buy, after he studied with us, he bought water coolers that will be put in every roadblock. So the soldiers will give out cold water to women and children who are in cars piling up at the roadblocks. Because 1 out of 10,000 cars may have a hand grenade in it, and that's the reality of Israel. But at the very same time, 99% of the people in the car are innocent Arabs. And he said a Jewish army should have on the right hand a rifle and the left hand cold water. And the army didn't pay for it. He raised money from Israel from Israelis. And in 2 months, he had the money to buy 71 water coolers. Now, my son, a few months ago, was in the roadblock next to Hebron. And he said it was Friday afternoon. He called me before Shabbat. And he says, Abba, we have here a box of a water cooler made in Germany, which is, you know, interesting. And he says, now the Chayalim, the soldiers, are debating who's giving out the cold water. Which means it balances not only the doing good, giving out to the others, but it's also balancing the soldiers in the roadblock to have a more complex, you know, duty. On one hand, they have to check the cars, but at the very same time, they're kind of dancing with power. On one hand, checking the cars, and on the second hand, giving out cold water. And so this person gets it. This is the Jewish army, that we can, on one hand, do the security issues, which we have to do. That's the reality of Israel. And this reality has prices to it. At the very same time, say there are people in these cars, some of these cars don't have air conditioning in the summer, who are waiting for 15, 20 minutes, sometimes an hour, to be checked, so let's give out cold water. Those are the kind of things that when they happen, I say this country has a real future to them, to it. So that's the kind of work we do. I'll go over with you some of the values that you don't have in your handouts, but I'll go over them quickly, and I want to do some study, and maybe, but are there any questions before I go into the next stage of my talk? Anybody want to ask anything? Yeah, I'll say something about this. It was Rabbi Soloveitchik who wrote many, many years ago a very important piece that I teach a lot in Israel. He said that there are two covenants of the Jewish people. One covenant is the covenant of faith, and the second covenant is a covenant of mission. He says that Yitziat Mitzrayim symbols the covenant of faith, and Matan Torah in Sinai is the covenant of mission. What does this mean? It means that when an Israeli soldier is captured by the enemy, all of Israel are united because of something happening in our everyday day life. That's a covenant over faith. When we have a tragedy, when a Chabad couple are killed in India, all of the Jewish people are united over the faith of the Jewish people. But the Rav Soloveitchik said there's a second element of Brit, of covenant. The second covenant isn't about the reality of our life and what happens in it, but is what is the mission of our people. And we can connect through a joint values, values that we share. That covenant is missing so much among the Jewish people. That's why in Israel there's unity usually at times of tragedy. After people are buried, after the funeral, people are back to business, and the cynicism and the hatred is back to the everyday life. And there has to be a unity. There has to be a brit, a covenant, not about the faith, the everyday life, but about the mission of our people. And that's exactly what these values are about. They're about to create a mission, a reason to continue this journey of the Jewish people in the Jewish state. So I agree with your remark. I think Israelis are united, usually at times of tragedy. We had a month ago a chance to be number one in the world in chess. I don't know if you heard of this. There was a contest between, and the Israeli Russian Ole lost at the finals, but Israel may one day, you know, be the best in the world in chess. So we also have reason to unite over good things. But usually it's over tragedies. And as we know, people can connect through an everyday life, and people can connect through a joint mission. And I believe today that we have to connect through Torah, which is about the future of our country, the future of our values. So I'll go quickly into the seven core values, and then we'll study together one of the values, and hopefully we'll have a discussion here. So the first, by the way, there are over 40 very elite and sophisticated people who were in this process, and as I said, from right to left, from secular to religious men and women, people who vote very differently. There are people there who live in Judea and Samaria. There are people there who won't pass the green line to visit people in Judea and Samaria. That's the kind of people who composed this this list. It wasn't made among my friends, my rabbis, or my chavura, but it was created by people from very, very different backgrounds. And this isn't, you know, I'm not Moshe Rabbeinu coming down with the commandments. This is something that can be teared, can be demolished. The idea of this is to create a discussion among the Jewish people, what values that we share. So nothing here is holy. You know, it's just a thesis for discussion. That's the idea. So the first value that we thought is crucial, and maybe it's an introduction to everything. I think you're missing it, so you'll have to hear it, and I have some more copies afterwards on the table here, so you can take it home with you. The first value, which is at the core of everything, in my understanding, is the fact that all people were created in Tzelem Elokim, in God's image. Now, why is this so crucial? I'll just say something in short. Now, you have to understand, every value that I'm talking about is at least 30 hours of study at Kolot. So I'm doing here something which is very not responsible, giving you a minute on every value, but what can I do? There's a major dispute in Jewish commentaries and philosophers. What is the Tzelem Elokim in us? According to the Rambam, Maimonides, the Tzelem Elokim is our mind, as our brain. According to some other rabbis in Spain at the very same time, more of the mystical tradition, it's the heart. It's and in the Talmud, Rabbi Akiva and Bet Hillel's approaches that Tzelem Elokim is our bodies, as our physical bodies. Now you can imagine what it means, what kind of dispute it is that if we say that Tzelem Elokim is the mind, or it's the body. It's two different understandings of what is the understanding of being created in God's image. But anyway, this means that all people in the world have Tzelem Elokim to them. This means that we have to take care of our bodies. There's a great story in the Talmud where Hillel one day was finishing his class, and towards the end of his class he says, I have to go to do a mitzvah. And his students asked him, what's a mitzvah more important than studying Torah with us? He says, I'm going to take care of my body. You know, they went to the spas, the rabbis in those days. They really took care of themselves. And the students ask Hillel, is that a mitzvah? And Hillel has a very, very strong, he says, of course it's a mitzvah. If the Romans we see outside take care of their statues so much, and they pay people to clean the statues, we are created in God's image. We have to take care of our bodies. And that's for Hillel is coming out of Ki Betzelem Elokim Asah Et HaAdam. So Tzelem Elokim is a basis for so many elements of our life. In other traditions, in mystical, in Sefer Yetzirah, the Tzelem Elokim is a speech, because speech is the highest degree of humankind according to some mystical approaches. So Tzelem Elokim is basically the basis for many of these values. And you can imagine there are many secular Israelis who looked at this, you know, we don't believe in God, we don't believe in Tzelem Elokim, but it was totally agreed that this is the basis, even for those who don't observe an everyday Jewish life. The second value, and I'll do this quickly because I want to get to the study very soon, is the power of speech. Judaism, from its very first days, saw the speech as or words as the world was created by God's word, by God's speech. We can destroy a person by our speech. We can create a world. We can create intimacy through speech. And the whole idea of can we take speech into a new consciousness in our everyday life, and also think of a new media, not just all these talk shows. I don't know how it is in this country, but Israel is dominated by the worst of Western TV. And can we imagine a new kind of media that will take words and take speech seriously? The third value is Arvut Hadadit, mutual responsibility, and that is that we care of every other person. We have two different understandings: if it's the inner Jewish community, or it's those who aren't Jewish. And in Israel, the whole idea of we are a majority for the first time in history in 2,000 years. Being a majority is a celebration. Being a majority is a responsibility to minorities who are under our capacity. The whole, you know, that we have this whole thing now going on with thousands of people coming in to Israel from Sudan. It was a big debate in Israel. Now, there's no way that Israel can keep all of these people. But the question is, do we remember the days that we were slaves in Egypt and we were looking for some kind of feeling of Tzelem Elokim? And I spoke a lot about this with Bibi a few weeks ago. And the government decided that they're going to send these people back to Eritrea, to Sudan, but give them $1,200 per adult, $500 per person, per child, basic clothes. And we're about to add a second element to all of this, is they'll have 2 months in Israel before they're sent back to get psychological help. The idea is that if these people came to Israel, Israel cannot accept tens of thousands of foreign workers coming in from the border of Egypt. But we have a commitment to take care of them as long as they're under our capacity and give them some gift on their way back. That's a Jewish country. You understand? That's what we're talking about. The fourth, yeah. It's a good question. Today in Israel, Haredi makes people alert. I think it's a very serious question, and the answer is not easy, an easy one. I think there are many Israelis who prefer their Druze soldiers who are with them in an army unit than any Haredi person. Now, you can understand, you can imagine what this means, that I have a very close friend who was with me in the war. A commander in one of the units I was part of, and a Jewish soldier saved his life in Lebanon 25 years ago. And he says to me, I'm 100% more close to the Jewish soldier than I am to any Haredi Jew, not only in Brooklyn, but also in Israel. Now, how do you debate that? How do you debate that? It's very, very difficult, not halachically, emotionally, morally. That's why I'm saying that it's... And I truly believe that as much as I think that there has to be a change in the Haredi world, people have to go back to working, there has to be an element of those who aren't studying seriously, and there's a great percentage of those who aren't studying seriously who should be going to the army. in an army where they can serve without women giving them commands and etc. We're doing our best to create this dispute in an honorable way. And in my teaching, I'll talk about that in a few minutes. So I'll get back there. I'll finish this very quickly. The fifth value is fourth. I said culture of dispute. That's number four. My teaching will be about the fourth value. So I'll get there in a second. We're talking about the fifth one is ownership and possessions. This is a very crucial one where we are talking about the idea of money, possessions, the whole idea of Shemitah, the sabbatical year. The whole world knows about Shabbat, but Shemitah isn't something that people know about. And I'll just say this in short. I'm part of a committee in Israel of educators working with some economical professors who are trying to think, is there a Jewish economy? Is there not just, giving out tzedakah or a communal understanding of tzedakah, but next time the world faces a financial crisis, and there are people who are saying that may happen sooner than later, can the Jewish people come up with a new thesis about what are possessions, what's the lust about money? Can we change the paradigm, which is a very, very ambitious way of thinking, but I truly believe that, the past crisis was about Madoff and all those who were hurt by Madoff. The Jewish people didn't come up, I feel that if the Jewish people can't come up with a new paradigm about economy, it's a chilul Hashem. I mean, it can't just be that we're always, connected to money and to scandals. There has to be, from a state point of view, a different approach. So I'm working about trying to create a new philosophy about Jewish economy. But anyway, the whole education about what's the role of money in school, in high school kids, what's this lust, the passion of making money, and what does Judaism have to say about this? Is this Yetzer Hara? It's a very central thing in our teaching. Number six is the relationship to the land of Israel. Of course, for people in the diaspora, what role does the land have in all of our dreams? In Israel, I talk a lot about the fact that Torah was given in Sinai. If Torah was given in Yerushalayim, I think history would be very different. If Torah was given in Yerushalayim, there was no chance of having a Toronto Jewish community, because that meant that Torah and land are one. Having Torah given in Sinai allows an opportunity to have a diaspora, to have Torah being lived outside of Israel. So for many Israelis, Sinai is a place to go on vacation. It isn't a place that we have any historical connection to. But the fact that we have a tension between Torah, which is beyond place, and Eretz Yisrael, which is the place, and how do they live together, the two. The seventh is the value that Rabbi Steinsaltz really wanted, and he says, if I'm in the process, this must be there. The whole idea of tikkun and repentance. And this is beyond just, becoming Baal Tshuvah, but it's saying that Jews have an obligation to rethink their journey every day of their life. And tikkun is about to rethink your paradigm, your thoughts, and to be fresh in your journey. And this ends the seven core values. I want to study with you, in short, the text that given out on the idea. Yeah, the ones that start with any dispute, which is for the sake of heaven. I'm afraid I don't. I made 30, knowing I'll have 10 people here. I think we'll have more. There are two versions, so if there are a few words that sound different, it's because I made today a different version of this, a different translation, but it's the same idea. So I just want to go into this kind of briefly and talk why do I think that the culture of dispute is such an important pillar in Jewish life. Many, many people in Israel and it can be from Orthodox to secular. When you say, you know, dispute, they start, you know, scratching their body. Dispute means, you know, fighting. It means cynicism. It means, you know, but any person who opens the Talmud knows that dispute is how our culture was created. Dispute isn't a problem, it's an opportunity. Every couple that has that doesn't have a dispute will probably live a very dull life. The question is, how can dispute be a passionate and creative way of living? For many people in Israel, when you say pluralism, it means live and let live. You know, you live there, I live here, and I don't want to hear about you. In Judaism, pluralism means that we may have different understandings, different commentaries, but we're all the time in dialogue. So I want to, you know, take these basic ideas and put them into text. So I guess all of you have heard of the Hillel and Shammai, you know, leaders, rabbis, Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai. For many Israelis, these are streets in Yerushalayim, but not figures that you've ever heard about. Hillel represents usually the idea of peace, and Shammai is more oriented towards truth, more strict Shammai. So the Pirkei Avot has a very famous saying, any dispute which is for the sake of heaven will in the end endure. Any dispute which is not for the sake of heaven will not endure. Which is a dispute that is for the sake of heaven? The disputes of the sages Hillel and Shammai. Which is a dispute which is not, that is not for the sake of heaven? The dispute of Korach and his entire congregation. That was a Parshat Shavuot of a few weeks ago. Let me ask you a question. Do you think most disputes are for the sake of heaven? Even, like, give me an example of something from your community, a dispute that you think is for the sake of heaven.
Or from the American team, whatever you think, give me an idea of it, of something which is an argument that's for the sake of heaven.
I think you're right. I think it's a very good example. The abortion issue. It's a very, you know, vicious discussion. But both sides have a heavenly, I guess, motivation in this. Other examples, maybe?
Abortion is not so much as it is here.
Yeah? Okay, interesting. So when I ask most Israelis, people find it very hard to find an example for the sake of heaven. But, you know, when we go deeper into this issue, and we don't have time for that, I believe that most disputes start at the sake of heaven. And as they go on, the ego starts arising, and very quickly they become not very heavenly. But if you look at many, many disputes, one of the things in Israel, we always talk about right and left, you know, the future of the land of Israel, or the Gush Katif dispute of 7 years ago. We can, doesn't matter what we think is right, but both sides had a motivation which was of the sake of heaven. It wasn't done well. That's something else. But basically, many disputes, even the idea of what's going to happen in Judea and Samaria in the future of Israel, doesn't matter what we think, but every side has something valid in its point of view. What happens very quickly is, as we start, you know, discussing, it becomes very personal, and very quickly we feel that it isn't at all in the sake of heaven. But anyway, so Hillel and Shammai represent the idea of the Shem Shamayim for the sake of heaven, and Korach, which we should have time to discuss right now, is considered not for the sake of heaven. Now, I want to study a very important text, number two, that for me is at the foundation of this pillar. Okay, and this is, in a way, it's also at the foundation of Kolot, the institute I run. Rabbi Abba, this is coming from Tractate Eruvin, page 13a.
Rabbi Abba said in the name of Shmuel, of Samuel, for 3 years, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel argued. The former said that law is according to our opinions. The latter said the law is according to our opinions. So the Talmud doesn't say what they were talking about for 3 years. We have no idea what they were fighting over for 3 years. But they were disputing for 3 years over a topic, right? And they were both very sure that, you know, each side is right. Then one day, a divine voice, a bat kol, some people say it's a feminine voice, but it's a bat kol, was heard saying the words of both are the words of the living God. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. But the law is in accordance with the school of Hillel. Now this is very, very important. The bat kol, the heavenly voice, says, after 3 years of discussion and disputing, Elu velu, these and those are the words of a living God. God can contain opposites. God can say he's for and against leaving Gush Katif. Why? Because he's in charge of this world on the earth. He's living in, like God is in a heavenly position where he can totally contain opposites. But in this world, the halacha is according to Bet Hillel. Okay, have that in mind. This is a very important beginning. So the editor of this piece goes on. But if the words of both are the words of the living God, on what basis did the school of Hillel merit the law should be determined in accordance with its positions? Why is the halakha according to Hillel if, according to a larger perspective, both are right? Why is the practical law in this world according to Bet Hillel? Now look at the answer. Because they were gentle and kind, or kindly and modest, and they studied their own rulings plus those of the school of Shammai, they were even so humble as to place the words of the school of Shammai before their own. When I studied to be a rabbi some many years ago, we had one class about how to give a sermon. And I remember the person who taught us, he says, always bring up your opponent to bash him afterwards. You know, my good friend says, and then you give him, you know, a shmir, and you, that isn't what they're saying here about Hillel. Hillel teaches Shammai's approach as part of his school, but more than that, he always starts with the Shammai point of view. Now, what does this mean? Why is he doing this? This isn't because he's tactful. He's doing this because he believes that if the heavenly voice says, these and those are the words of living God, so when I teach, I have to try to give the heavenly opposites the full presence in my teaching. Now, by the way, when they say this, it means that Shammai doesn't mention Hillel in his teaching, right? Why? Because Shammai is about truth and false, and Shammai looks at Hillel as a false opinion. But Hillel, even though he totally disagrees with Shammai on so many areas of life, he believes that in order to have a larger consciousness, a broad education, I must bring the position of Shammai in my teaching and even start with that position. And by doing this, he's endangering his students who may find something very interesting in the Shammai approach. Now, many times when I ask people, you know, why do you think a person halakha is according to him? People will say, because he's right. But no one here is saying that Hillel is right. No one here is saying that Hillel is smarter than Shammai. There's even a Talmudic piece that says that in the Olam Haba, the world to come, the halakha will be according to Shammai. But they're saying, in this world, those who will win the battle, those who will win over Judaism, who will lead the Judaism, it won't be those who are only truth-oriented, but it's those who can totally contain the other in their teaching. And this is a very, very, I mean, very difficult thing to live according to. For many Israelis, and I guess also for many of you, to live a life where you say, I will always bring my opponent into the room. By the way, I do an exercise with small groups in Israel. And in our teachings, we have people from very, very different points of view. And after we study this, I ask every person for 1 minute to stand up and give, like close his eyes, choose his ultimate opponent. and try to meditate, find the heavenly voice in your opponent, and now give his approach without too many introductions. Just give it out for 2 minutes. It's a very difficult exercise. Do it once with yourself. Think of your opponent. It could be in politics. It could be in any part of life. Think of the heavenly part of his position, and then say it out as if in a very positive way. That's the Hillel approach. Very, very difficult to do, to live according to. I want to say something about this text. It was this time of the year, 7 years ago, in Gush Katif, when, it was towards the leaving of the actual disengagement of Gush Katif. And I was, at the time, I moved to Gush Katif. I live in Yerushalayim, but I was asked to move to Gush Katif to try to create dialogue between the Israeli Armenian leadership who were about to take to do this task, and some of the rabbis and leaders in Gush Katif. And for me, these 3 weeks of Ben Netzarim were the 3 weeks exactly. But if you remember, it started on Motzei Tisha B'Av. That's when the actual leaving started. And I was there for 3 weeks. I left my family, my work, and it was the highest point of my career to create dialogue between officers who knew exactly which family they're going to evacuate. It was a very personal, very intimate, very painful, and I must say, it doesn't matter what you think about it, it wasn't right. It was very, very poorly planned, as you all know. Until this very day, there are people who don't have a good housing. This is, 7 years later. Anyway, on the night of, on the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, that year Tisha B'Av was on Saturday night, I think like this year. It was on Sunday. And on that Shabbat, and the first day of the Hitnatkut, of the disengagement, was Motzei Tisha B'Av. It was a Monday. That was the date that was supposed to start for, I think 5 or 6 days. And that Shabbat, I was in a settlement called Atzmona. But by the way, I was there, and they were sure I'm a person of the Shin Bet, spying. It took me a long time to be, that they'll look at me in a way that they can trust me. Not all of them did, but at the end I had some trust. And on Shabbat, one of the rabbis who I became very close to at the time gave a sermon after Shacharit. And he said, the government decided that on Monday we're about to leave our homes. He asked people, do not start packing because God will not allow this to happen. And I'm sitting there and people are, very courageous listening to him. I hear from all the homes, Zmirot Shabbat, people are singing as if it's an ordinary Shabbat. And I know, I went on Friday to see the plans. The plans were so in detail. And I said, they have no idea what they're facing. I went to the rabbi and he said to me, go away. God will not allow this to happen. So on Saturday night, the fast started. And I created a dialogue on the beach of one of the beaches in Gush Katif, by the way, was a beautiful beach. And we had there 11 rabbis and 15 high-ranked officers from the army. And I asked the IDF people to talk to the rabbis. And then we studied this text about Machlok Deshem Shamayim. How do we have a dispute for the sake of heaven? And I tried to ask every person in that circle. Some of them were fasting, some of them weren't fasting. Can you just enter the shoes of the other side? Can you, as a rabbi, understand that this officer isn't right or left? He's a shaliach, he's a messenger of the Israeli government. And can you, as an officer, understand that these people were sent here by the Israeli government to do God's work in this world? But try to really go into the other side totally. And it was a very beautiful moment in my life, I must say, because it was going on for 2 hours. People were talking, and I asked them, do this exercise. And each IDF officer spoke about how he would feel if he was at a home. And each rabbi, it was very hard for them, had to say, I'm part of a democratic state with all the pain of this. Now, that doesn't mean he accepts. He means he understands what may happen on Monday. That Sunday morning, the rabbis went back to their communities and said, this is going to happen. And one of the rabbis who I totally, he was in high school a year under me, Rabbi Shmuel Tal, went to his yeshiva, which was a yeshiva, a Hezra yeshiva, so they had arms, and he collected 120 rifles, because they were very, very radical guys in his yeshiva, and he collected personally. He went from room to room, and he said, I want to have all the ammunition locked up. And it was those hours that created relatively a peaceful disengagement. And by the way, in the Shin Bet preparing, there was I saw charts of 8 people expected to be killed and 35 being injured. That was the expectations before the actual disengagement. But I'm telling you all this because before the rabbis and army officers went away on Saturday night after that very powerful discussion, one of the rabbis says, we have one request, and everybody came back into the circle. We have one request. If this really is going to happen on Monday, can you please speak to mayors of cities in the Tel Aviv area, of Ramat Gan, Tel Aviv, Givatayim, Cholon, Bat Yam, in the center of Tel Aviv, to try to close the coffee shops for 1 hour in the afternoon, so we'll feel that the people in the center of Israel care about what's happening right now in Gush Katif. Because it means that if we were a proper society, that means that even if the majority are for the actual disengagement, we can feel that they care. They can somehow contain our pain by closing the coffee shops. And everybody, including myself, on the other side, said, of course, we will do our best to make this happen. And all of Sunday, it was a fast day. Me and some other people who were there went out, and I went to Ariel Sharon, and I did my best. And so to get to some of these mayors to please close down the coffee shops on Monday at 1 o'clock for 1 hour, that was the request, and we didn't succeed. A proper society would be a society that says, if we have to do this, it'll be done. But there'll be a way that Am Yisrael will feel the pain, and we didn't succeed in doing this, even though I was sure that'll be. And people had different reasons why they can't do it, you know. But this is what I'm talking about. The culture of dispute at its highest level is where we say we totally disagree about major things, but we can totally see the God element in your point of view. That, to me, is one of the hopes for Israel, that we can have a Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim, which probably will have a different Jewish life, but we share a text, we share a vocabulary, we share a mission, and we respect the other side, even though we may live the practical life in a different way. So this is one of the values that I wanted to share with you, the value of dispute, which I think is crucial for our people. So I want to end my opening or my frontal talk at this moment, and I would like to hear some remarks. And let's go on. Look, I don't have a lot of influence on the Haredi community. They're going to go through a major shock in the next few years, maybe if next few months. That's for sure. A shock means that a financial shock, because if for years the governments have been supporting, the taxpayers have been paying a lot of money to keep the yeshivot running, that's going to change. Hopefully not dramatically, but it's going to change. And I think a lot of work has to be done the same way it was done, you know, in Gush Katif. I mean, every person who's hurt by a decision has to be embraced at the highest level. It doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. It should be done, in my view. I think there should be a change. I think Israelis are really, really tired of the system of supporting a community that generally is not working. There are people who are, but there's a... You know, in 1952, I'll share with you a very important story. When I teach people in Israel about the Haredi issues, and people are in shock to see how major Jewish thinkers like the Rambam, I guess you know this, but Rambam has a very radical point of view, how every rabbi shouldn't make a living out of being a rabbi, but every rabbi must have a different, how do you say, melechet kapayim, a business to make funny. Rambam has a very radical point of view of making money out of education and spiritual giving. But and he says really radical things about this, and people in Kolot can't believe this is Judaism. A person asked me a few weeks ago, is Rambam an important Jew? Like, they couldn't believe this is, you know, this is serious stuff. And by the way, the same thing about going to war. It's the clear halachic point of view about Mechemim Mitzvah, about a war that we have to go into, says that even a kala, even a bride, has to leave her chuppah to join the forces. There's very little backing to not be part of the army when there is real war. But so it's very clear to me that the center field of Jewish halakha and philosophy is very much for the anti-Haredi movement in a way, which is very strange. But when I teach this to people, and they, in a way, they're shocked to see these texts that are so for, you know, for work, for entering the army, I remind them a very important story. In 1952, the Chazon Ish, who was the head of the Haredi community, a great, great rabbi from Bnei Brak, he met Ben Gurion. That's when they created the status quo on marital issues, and that's where they agreed on 400, at the time, 400 students who won't go to the army. That was the number in 1952. And I'll tell you two stories about that very important meeting that created the status quo today in Israel. One story is that when Ben Gurion came back to his kibbutz in Sde Bokel, people asked him, how did you ever give the Haredim, you know, so much power? He says, the Haredim, you know, they are the end of their history. They won't last more than 20 years. Now, the Chazon Ish came back to Bnei Brak, and he said, they asked him, how did you, you know, agree to have an agreement with the secular government? He says, secular, that's something new. It has no chance to stand more than 20 years. And they were both wrong. That's one story. But the more important story is that if you look at the summary of the meeting, and I have it in Hebrew in Israel, the Chazon Ish told Ben Gurion the following. He said to him, the Holocaust totally demolished the center of the Torah world. I'm asking you of 50 years of grace and living an abnormal Jewish life for us to recreate the world of Torah. Now, this is beautiful. I'm a son of two Holocaust survivors, and to read that in 1952, the Chazon Ish says, we need 50 years of an abnormal Jewish life of not working. I'm not going to the army because we have to recreate the world of Torah in Israel. Now, what's sad about this thing is that the Haredi world made it a normal life, and 50 years are over. Two things happened since then. But I tell people in Israel, try to understand the nigun, feel the feeling of a person or a community that feels that until 1939, the yeshiva world had a major presence in every community in the world that was totally demolished in the Holocaust. That's what I say. Look at the essence of the other opinion. Even though, and I totally don't agree with it. You know, I studied in yeshivas. I was ordained as a rabbi, and I was an officer in the army. I'm not a gadol Torah, but I believe that you can combine the two. I totally believe in that at the bottom of my heart, that a person can combine the two worlds, and the best rabbis in the Talmud combined the two worlds. The majority of the rabbis in the Talmud had a profession and were great scholars. But what I'm saying is that even though I totally disagree with the Haredi position, I feel where they come from. I understand the pain. I understand what the Chazon Ish told Ben Gurion. So it creates a different kind of dialogue. I can have a major dispute, and at the very same time, embrace the person I'm fighting with. And that's the culture I'm trying to teach in Israel. And it's so missing in our country. Yes. Have you all heard the question? Oh, okay. I'll repeat the question, which is a very essential question. Why is it that Judaism looks so bad in Israel, and how do we recreate Judaism as relevant for the younger generation? I will say something very clear about this. And for many people, Judaism is about very high values, spirituality. For me, when I teach Judaism, it's about food, it's about sex, it's about our everyday life. And the more it'll talk about those issues, we have a better chance. The more we talk about Judaism as being a Shabbat religion, only about the end of the week, about our spiritual part of our life, we will lose the battle. But if we really learn how Judaism is about the way we talk, about relationships, about money, that's why possessions is so important. All those things that youngsters care about so much, and say that's where you have to start the journey. I think that's the only way. And thank God there's so much about this in Judaism. I'm very sad that so many people who lead Judaism in Israel and in the world don't see these issues as a center of Judaism. They talk too much about Hashem, too much about, I'm a big Hashem believer, but it's only about believing God and spirituality. It's about the everyday life, where I think Judaism has a major message for all of us. But that's the only way I see it. It's through the very, you know, the, here again, I'm a Hillel person. There's a very beautiful dispute in Tractate Beitza, that Shammai would go to the market on Sunday. He would see a beautiful piece of meat and says, this is for Shabbat. And his whole week was about preparing for Shabbat. If you would see like a nice watermelon, he would say, this is for Shabbat. But Hillel would go to the market and he says, I see a piece of meat, I'll have it today. Because he says, Baruch Hashem, Yom Yom. In everyday life, that's where I find Hashem, not on Shabbat. And I'm very much a Hillel person. I believe that Judaism is about the secular parts of our life, and how to take them to a different dimension in a higher level. But that's the Torah I teach. It isn't to say that your life is wrong. It's to take what you believe in, your passion, your lust, and find the divine in those parts of life. And you know, that's how we teach. I think it's the only way to reconnect to Torah. And I think, you know, we have to somehow separate our politics from religion. It's not doing good for Judaism. But that's something else. Yeah. Wow. I thought I'm having fun this evening. I didn't think we were going to have such sound. The question is, how do I take the Hillel and Shammai art of dispute and translate that into the denominations, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Reconstructionist? You have all these. Well, thank God that in Israel we don't deal with this too much, because in Israel the denominations have not really succeeded. Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, by the way. I mean, I'm totally a post-denominational, I've learned this word in America, post-denominational Jew, which means I believe that we really have to create a Judaism which is beyond the different movements. All I can say is one thing about this very, you know, difficult question. I believe that if a person is a serious Torah studier, if you take the study seriously, I give a person a lot of credit to that. And what he does with that, for me, is a very, very high level of choice and his way of Jewish living. I don't come out and say any movement is wrong. In Israel, again, the movements don't have a lot of place. The Reform and Conservative movements have created synagogues, but people don't go to synagogue in Israel. Synagogue isn't where Israelis are going to make their first entree into Judaism. It's much more through study. And the study hasn't been the power of the movement in Israel at all. They have created communities of egalitarian sitting, and people may do their bar mitzvot in different synagogues, but when it comes to the real Jewish journey, it's not where the Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox have created, you know, a real option for Israelis. So my take about, you know, Hillel and Shammai, or how do you create the modern Hillel and Shammai? Serious study of Torah. That's my guide. And I don't judge people once they take Judaism seriously. But that's my personal understanding of this. Number two is?
Rabbi Abba said,
So you're asking?
Have you attempted to translate it into secular terms? So you have a discussion with secular people, such as philosophy is based on these principles, mathematics, science, listening to the alternative point of view, and even looking for criticisms, counter examples. And I always try to make your opponent look good, right? Not just creating a straw person, they call it, but trying to find a really strong position. Put that in terminology, the strong position.
Mm-hmm.
The strongest position you can do, or else your arguments are just silly.
Yeah, I haven't done it outside my world, but it sounds like a very good idea to do that.
Yeah, you can put this in terms of current philosophers or mathematicians, scientists. Einstein had a famous debate with Max Born all his life, and that, you know, Einstein was opposed to quantum mechanics. Max Born was
Good idea. Wait, somebody else? Yes. No, good question. You know, on Saturday night after the Friday night meal at Paris, I went back to his house, and I asked him the question. I asked him, "Do you want this to be created for the Israeli people, the Israeli state, or for the Jewish people?" And he said immediately, "The Jewish people." Now, what's the difference? If it was the Israeli state, we had to have Bedouins and Druze and Arabs as part of the process because they're part of the Israeli citizenship. And it was very clear from day one that these are Jewish values of the Jewish people. For me, at least, I would say the most important experiment of the Jewish people is the state of Israel. You can think differently, but it isn't about the Israeli state. It's about values of the Jewish people. You know, since last year, we're working now with three federations in San Francisco, LA, and Philadelphia about these values, working with their leaders. Can these values be the values of their community as well? So it's beyond Israel, but our focus in Kolod is within Israel. That's our focus, but the idea is to talk about this and try to, you know, lead this outside of Israel for the larger Jewish community. But the values aren't Israeli, the values are Jewish. Yeah. I think there are opinions that are outside of Elu Ve'elu, for sure. Okay, I can't give an answer to that. It's a very difficult question. What are the exact boundaries of what's beyond? But there are things on the right and left, okay, that I think that aren't in the, you know, in the boundaries of Hillel and Shammai. I said that for me, what creates the inner circle is serious study. But I can't define the boundaries of who's in and out on both sides. I can say that a person just decides what his life is without study isn't part of the ball game. And if a person is, this week's parsha is Pinchas. There's a kind of a zealotry that's outside of the ball game on the right. But I can't define exactly what is the boundaries. But definitely there are points of view that are outside the Hillel and Shammai spectrum. I agree that it has to be defined. I can't give answers on everything, but it's a very good question, and all I can say is I wish we had an interesting discussion about that in the larger Jewish community. What defines the boundaries of Hillel and Shammai? That's a great seminar, a great task. Yeah. look, we can't take care of all world issues in Israel. I mean, I don't think they're going to solve the issues in Eritrea and Sudan, which are, you know, worldwide tragedies. All I can talk about is Tzelem Elokim, is God's image. If a person enters your land, and he's the exact kind of person you were as a slave in Egypt, you have to look at him as if v'zachar tekev v'ayit abelet Mitzrayim. All you have to do is look at this person in the eye and say, I can do my best. I'll tell you a story. I don't know, until 3 years ago, Israel had a gigantic tragedy of 3,000 women a year coming into Israel through the border of Egypt as sex workers. It's changed in the past 3 years. It's better. Numbers are lower. But for 30 years, Israel had thousands of women a year coming in, forced into the country by Bedouins. Many of them knew what they were doing, but it was a big tragedy. I did once my reserves in the border of Egypt. This is maybe 10 years ago, one of the last times I did reserves. And at the time, there was intelligence of women coming in with these Bedouins. It's a terrible journey that they all went through. And we had on our kind of a large jeep that we did, we had a psychologist among us, that if we catch one of these things, the first thing they'll have there is a social worker or a psychologist. This was 5 months, and it ended because it was a budget issue for the army to have a social worker on the jeep. And imagine what that means, that every army jeep at the time, I was shocked. I came to the 30 days of my miluim, of my reserves, and the first day we meet these social workers who are telling us how to act if you catch these women. I mean, it's a beautiful army. I mean, it was a great month of just, you know, sitting, and all we cared about is, can we catch these women and have these social workers taking care of them? That for me is we can't solve all the issues. You know, the issues of trafficking women. Thank God Israel has changed its policy in the past 3 years. Now a fence is being built, and there was a change in Israel of the whole issue of prostitution in the past 3 years. But for many, many years, it's been a major issue and nobody cared about it. But the question is, can you give the person, and even in this case, women who are caught, can you give them 6 months of rehab, of mental rehab? That, to me, is what I mean about having a Jewish country and the attitude towards minorities. By the way, if I may say this, may not be popular in this crowd, I think Israel has sinned to Israeli Arabs, not Palestinians, to Israeli Arabs since 48. Citizens of the country should have the exact same sewer system that I have in my community. Israel has an obligation towards minorities, by definition of a Jewish state. Not because we're humanist, because we're Jewish. So, and I truly believe in this. Doesn't matter what I think is the larger political solution. But we have a major obligation towards minorities. If there are foreign workers working, building the country, and don't get good salaries or paid under the average, that's a Jewish avira. It's a Jewish sin. And it's beyond, you know, legal stuff, because we have a major commitment to minorities who are under our capacity. Okay, so let's, yeah. We're working on it.
Because you mentioned the humanism, you can translate.
I agree. Well, look, I think it's most important journey happening in Israel. Until 2 years ago, I would say Yerushalayim is lost to the Haredim. I think that's changing. There are good things happening on both sides, in both cities, and I think that's where a lot of the future is going, and we're trying to help that, at least on the Tel Aviv side. Thank you very much for being with us. I have her some kolot brochures. If you want to take home and read with them, please go ahead.